wake up in your face on the bedroom carpet. Count back all the ways that you ended up there. Can't remember someone else's story. You can't remember that you don't feel sorry. So get up, get out.
Hi everyone, welcome to Under My Host. I'm Corey. Happy New Year. Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Yes. Today, Corey, of course. We've got Brian Sullivan, our air quote, one of our producers, Maddie CK, our other producer, Ken Schramm of Schramm's Meadery, or Schramm's Mead, excuse me, in Ferndale. You're in Ferndale or you're in Troy?
We're in Ferndale.
Ferndale, okay. And then Ron Jeffries is back. Ron, this is Ken's first time, Ron's second time joining us. And Ron is, of course, the founder brewer of Jolly Pumpkin Artisan Ale in Dexter. And so both of the guys are in Michigan. It's a Michigan show today.
It's a Michigan show.
And then we've got Jeremy Danner, one of the craft columnists and the ambassador brewer Boulevard Brewing Company in Kansas City, Missouri. And Matt Pond is joining us. Matt, of course, is a musician, and he's been sitting in with us quite a bit. And he's also writing for Craft now. So he is, I have sucked him into the web that is Craft.
About me.
Well, no. Okay. We won't talk about your article until it publishes.
All right,
but yes.
We can't talk about anything.
Exactly. Nothing that's not published yet. But welcome everybody. I'm very excited to have the guys on. Of course, like I said, we've had Ron on before. So if you want to know Ron's backstory, go look up the old show. I don't want to waste time, you know, talking about stuff that he's already discussed with us. He's very interesting. It's really one of our most listened to shows. So, and really he's back a lot sooner than people that we have back on because people were requesting for him to come back. And then also Ken Schramm, a lot of people, Ken recently left, has retired. He's been producing mead. Everybody knows, 2003, he wrote The Complete Mead Maker. But he was in, I think he was in film production or in media. And he, as of just I think like this past year, has decided to become a full-time mead maker. So we're excited to have the guys on. Everybody, we've got questions. Corey King has sent in questions that he wanted me to ask Ken. And then we've got Ashley Bauer, who's a home brewer, and she works for a distributor in I think it's North Carolina. She's in South Carolina. She has questions. So we've got some stuff that we need to talk about. But welcome, guys. I really want to touch on Ken real quick because he's not had a chance. Brian talked to Ken for our for his article in our new issue on the relationship that producers have with farmers. Ken comes from a long line of farmers. His family has been farming in Michigan for, 100 years?
Yeah.
So
more than 100 years,
yeah, for a very long time. So why don't we, will you just talk, like, I hate saying this, you know, the elevator pitch for Schramm's Mead, so people, our listeners that may not know you, know what you're about and your background in mead making?
Sure. Schramm's is a small meadery located in the Metro Detroit area that specializes in meads that are done with whole ingredients. We use whole fruits. We use real ginger. We're essentially trying to do things old school, as it were. And we're really demanding in terms of what how our fruits are sourced and how our ingredients are used. We use a lot of old style processes. We do fermentations on fruit and pigiage or punch downs on all of our stuff. And it's nothing magic, but it's just utilizing very traditional techniques to try and maximize the flavor that we have in our products.
It is magic, though, because not everybody can do it.
We're tasting the statement
we're drinking the statement and we're all, he's rubbing his nipples and we're O-facing like it's.
Magic is putting it lightly.
It's really, really good, Ken. And of course, the statement is really the one that we have tonight to drink. It is incredible.
Yeah,
and I don't know if you want to, do you want to just talk about, like, as an example, like how I always explain, and I think I did it like when we had Brad on, and I hope it's not offensive to other people. To me, Schramm's is so much more like the winemaker's approach. And I think a lot of the stuff that's become really popular has more of a craft beer angle to it, whether they're hopping it, some of the flavors that they're putting in and the things that they're doing.
Even the look of it. I mean, it has.
Well, I mean, it's like super, super elegant. Like, I mean, just the way drinking it, it's so nice. And this is what mead should taste like. And I love, don't get me wrong, I think the bee nectar stuff is wonderful and I think it's a lot of fun, but to me this is like what he's saying, it's like it is very traditional, but it's done so well, because we've all had really beautiful, we've had beautiful wine that's done in a traditional way and we've had really bad wine that's been done in a traditional way. So it's I love this, and I don't really know of another, and he may, because he's been in mead production for so long, I don't know anybody else who's doing mead like this.
This is a pretty unique product that I've tasted. And
well, yeah, right. So we're done stroking your ego for a little bit. You can go back to talking about. I mean, what do you feel the misconceptions are about mead? And I know, like for Matt, you know, Matt's had really bad examples, and you know, Chris Kessler just wrote that article, which was really good, and it's funny because he and it was the mention that Ken had made was that he doesn't go into Beowulf and all of like the Vikings and all this ridiculous crap that's just not really relevant to the production. It's just this like that's the mystical magical stuff that's stupid. But when you have people coming in and they haven't had mead before, they've had it and it's nothing, they haven't had the same experience as they have with yours. Like what do you think people should know about mead that are looking at a shelf and they see it and they're not sure if they want to buy it?
Well, the mead is it's a little more expensive in terms of production than beer. Just because the honey is such an expensive ingredient. As a fermentable, it's probably the pound for pound the most expensive thing that's available to ferment. Mm-hmm. He's always been the quote-unquote beverage of kings, and that has a lot to do with it. Honey's always been precious, and it's one of the few things that still has to be hand-harvested. So if things seem a little spendier than you're accustomed to laying out for, for example, for one of Ron's really delicious beers, that's a big part of it. And in terms of what we're doing, we're looking at our products. We're looking to maximize the impact of the ingredients, and so we're going to use a lot of fruit, probably more than that I know anyone else is using right now. And we're going to try and, the statement that you're drinking right now, is the entire nature of the beverage is that it's a statement of how good a cherry mead can be. We're going to use really good honey, and we're going to use Valentin cherries from Smelter Orchards in Traverse City. And we're going to try and express that whole package of flavors as well as we possibly can. So it's going to be a little more expensive than some of the other beverages that you can buy. And that's something that people that come from, sort of like a beer or a craft beer background, they're getting more and more used to. If you come to this from the wine perspective, it's always been the case that the more exclusive wines end up at higher price points, mm-hmm. because the people that are making them are really working hard to obtain the best fruit they can and using the best production techniques, and that ends up being costly.
Well, and you know what I want to talk about, and this would really be to both of you. When Brian, I talked to Ken on, because I wanted a feature. I was going to be featuring the statement in the same issue. And just talking to Ken, he's very, very passionate about he grew up around farming. He does, you know, garden and grow stuff. He's got a very strong working relationship with the people that he buys his honey from. So he had that really strong connection. And I knew that that was somebody that we definitely needed to include in your article. And then I'm curious also, Ron, I don't think we touched on this on your show. Do you try to work, and Michigan is such an easier place to do this. Do you try to work with farmers to get your raw ingredients? You know, I know probably not hops.
Hop production's huge in Michigan.
Is it?
Yeah.
So,
Actually, we probably buy, other than our restaurants, but we work a lot in our restaurants. We do as much as we can with local growers, and with Michigan as the second most diverse agriculture after California. Actually, a lot less citrus, obviously. Mm-hmm. So we work with as many local growers as we can with the restaurants, and now people are putting in more and more hoop houses, so we've got more selection of produce throughout the year. But in the beers, it's mostly hops, and the hop industry in Michigan is really getting quite big, and I buy literally tons of Michigan hops, mostly Cascade and Chinook. I'm trying to get some growers to do some Crystal for me and a couple other varieties, but hops are the big one for us. We do buy a little Michigan malt. It's still kind of a very small thing that mostly is only enough that we can do for our pubs, mm-hmm. for local, you know, distribution. But otherwise, it's hops. That's what we buy the most of. Like I said, literally tons of them. Every year.
Really nice. And can most of your fruit, I know not all, but isn't most of your fruit coming from local producers?
Yeah, we buy from a Michigan source for our Ballantine cherries, and yeah. We also buy the raspberries that we use in our raspberry mead from a farmer in Michigan. And we buy from Hunt's Hillside Berries, and they're down in the southwestern portion of the state. Their fruit is terrific. We got clued into them by Rex Halfpenny, who's also part of the whole culture in Michigan. And then I know Ron's a friend of his, and he's been Rex has been helpful to us in terms of cluing me into the sources. We have not yet been able to find a source of blackberries in Michigan, but the berries that we're getting from Hunt's are better than what we were able to purchase in the past, and that's terrific for us because we're buying directly from the grower.
Do you guys, Danner? I know that you're gonna have questions for Ron, but is there anything that you would want to ask or have any questions for Ken?
You know, I'm kind of mead stupid, so I feel like a lot of people have had. Like, people think about mead, mm-hmm. and they think it's always going to be really syrupy sweet and not complex. So if someone's looking to get into mead, are there, like, styles of mead or types that you suggest starting with to kind of begin that journey towards drinking better mead?
Well, I'm a fan of meads that have a lot of acidity. If you're going to have some residual sweetness, and our meads do have residual sweetness, and we like to leave a little bit of honey flavor in our meads because people expect that.
Right.
But if you're going to do that, then you have to balance it with acidity. That's why we use high acid fruits. We're really fans of. I mean, if you look at our lineup, blackberries, raspberries, and tart cherries, all three of those fruits are fruits that have much higher acid levels than traditional wine grapes, for example, or for that matter, higher than apples. So that's probably a good starting point. But if you want to learn to balance acidity and sweetness, start playing that way and figure out what the amounts of fruit and the amounts of residual sweetness are that you like. And as a home mead maker, that's a fun game to play. There are a lot of really good high acid fruits. We're working with new things right now that we're piloting, things along lines of cranberries and pineapple and other fruits like that. Plenty of tropical fruits, passion fruit, for example. There's a couple of things we've been looking at. Acerola is one that we're examining right now. But But find that flavor profile that you're interested in obtaining, and then begin working on how to nail that down. Our real goal is to be able to formulate the recipe so that when the meat finishes fermenting, the residual sugar that we end up with and the amount of tartness that we get from the fruit are in balance. But that's because we're commercial. We really want to sort of nail that. But if you're a home meat maker, you can back sweeten or add additional acidity at the end, and not worry about whether or not you're messing with the formula that the TTB has got for you. So you can really tinker hard as a home meat maker.
You know, I don't want to cut you off if you have another question, but before we get away from that, all of the questions, of course, that came from Corey, because he's a brewer. If listeners don't know who Corey King is, Corey King is the founder and the brewer of Side Project, which, you know, is a phenomenal line of beers. And he's also the head brewer for Perennial. So I actually, a long time ago, he was talking about Ken and Ken's mead. And I don't know if you guys actually formally know each other. He just buys your mead and he drinks it. He's a big, big fan. So I knew, even though we couldn't get another call in on the show, I knew he would want to have some questions. So he did want to ask, he's never produced mead. Of course, he loves your mead. What's one of the important things for someone new to making mead needs to watch in their earlier batches?
The two things are nutrient levels and pH. pH can be something that will cause either stuck fermentations or prolonged fermentations, and both of those will frequently end up yielding off flavors. And by the way, before I go too far, I have to say I'm a fan of Corey's, and I'm really honored. I saw that he had done a beer that was a take on the Heart of Darkness, and yeah, we are anxious to try that here.
Oh, I'll have
Detroit
to let
beer.
Him know.
We're waiting very impatiently to figure out a way to get a bottle of that up here. But James is my head meat maker. Alison is the director of operations. James pointed it out to me and said, "Ken, did you know this was going on?" And I said, "Well, no, not really."
I didn't even know that. Yeah, I mean, I knew, I've known for a long while that he's been a fan of yours. I didn't realize that he did a tribute to you. Oh, that's great. Yeah,
I'm very humbled by that, and I'm glad James clued me in. And all of us, the three of us, are anxious to try that. So, anyways, the pH is one key thing. If you need to make some adjustments, we have in meats where we are worried about pH, we use potassium bicarbonate in limited amounts, but just we try to keep the pH above 3.3 or 3.4 during fermentations, and nutrient levels. If you're making meads with just honey or with very limited number of ingredients, and spiced meads are very much in this category, you can end up with not enough nitrogen for the yeast to be able to make it through the fermentation and reach your desired alcohol level, and that can result in stuck fermentations as well, or prolonged fermentations of flavors. So, keep track of that. There are a number of good articles online. There's the Mike Sapolsky's Staggered Nutrient Edition protocol. Or you can just Google up the article I wrote on optimizing honey fermentation. And there's some really sound advice in there on how to get to the kinds of nitrogen levels that will keep your yeast happy. So, yep. Eat the yeast.
Happy yeast. Gotta have happy yeast, right, Ron? So
absolutely.
I got an email earlier. Matt, you know, is very new to all of this. So he's he immediately was trying to find out. He must have read something about you because he started to look for the differences between yeast and bacteria in beer. And then, which prompted me to tell Danner we really need to do a show at some point because we assume that everybody knows this stuff. I mean, like, you just get beyond it, you know, and you forget that there's people that, like, how does this even happen? And I think it is really good for people, whether they're going to be brewing or not. I don't think we have to get too into detail with them. But I think if anybody can answer that question succinctly, well, both of them can, really. As far as, you know, for somebody like Matt trying to find out the difference, what is the difference in alcohol and beer production with yeast and bacteria? And you're, I guess, since, you know, talking about your wild ales, the sours, especially, we'll get on to like kettle stuff and the barrel stuff after you explain that.
For simplification.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, let's make it like they're separate.
Because he's going to be like, just, yeah.
Right. I mean, I guess I would need more clarification of the question to be quite concise about it. But basically what we're looking for is we have a primary fermentation with a brewer's yeast that gives us our alcohol. And then eventually when we bottle condition with yeast, our carbonation, as well as a whole host of flavor compounds. And then with the bacteria, we do get some flavor contribution, but we also get acid production, which gives us the sourness, which, of course, is different than Brettanomyces, which also gives us other fruit flavors and whatnot. But just with talking about yeast and acid production or bacteria, we get the alcohol, the CO2, flavor compounds, and then just the acid component from the bacteria, more or less. I mean, there's flavors too, but...
Right. And of course, apart from the actual alcohol that...
We, from the bacteria, we don't get a lot of alcohol. It's mostly just acids. And in fact, some bacteria will convert some of that alcohol back into different acids.
Well, and then when you're introducing the yeast back after bottling, that's when they're doing like the second fermentation. And right?
Yes. Right. Yeah. For us, it would actually be a third because we have naturally occurring wild yeast in all of our oak. And so we have a second fermentation in there with different Brett strains that we haven't pitched. They've just shown up. So they're kind of Dexter wild yeast. And then a third fermentation in the bottle to mostly do the carbonation, but also some finishing flavors come out as well.
That's what's slightly confusing is the yeast that's just naturally... the bacteria that's just naturally occurring, is there any way to control that or to monitor it?
Sure. You could do all sorts of controls. I mean, bacteria, just like any... we do temperature controls. We do environmental controls. We do kind of upper-level management. We don't really get down and dirty with the stuff. Sure. We let it do its own thing. And hopefully it doesn't get too out of control and we don't have to go in and do like a scorched earth kind of policy on any of the barrels. But,
right.
But mostly we've decided we want this cooperative environment. So we try to make an environment that is going to foster the activity that we're looking for. So yeah, there are some controls, but it's not like just a regular brewery fermentation where it's all sterile except for one strain and you keep it at a particular temperature and you step up and down. It's a little more natural and organic than that.
Which, okay. Dan, are not, you know, not for me, but that's pretty much what you're doing at Boulevard, right? Where it is more controlled. Like do you do most of your stuff like kettle, your sours are done in the kettle, right?
Definitely not all sours. I think there are styles where it's
appropriate.
We're doing that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We're doing our Goza is kettle soured, but right. like the Love Child beers, the Flanders Style Red, and those are soured in barrels, you know, over time.
I haven't had the Love Child yet. Not surprising.
So Jeremy, we have on our yogurt in the tap room, yogurt, kettle sour, hop forward, Goza, which was dry hopped. So it's a hoppy wheat IPA with salt that may have been soured in the kettle. With yogurt. I don't think I can ship you a growler that will arrive well, but you should come out and try it. I need to come up there. I need to go.
Now, Ken, is that something you would you ever introduce bacteria into a mead?
Well, we're not
at this point, we're not introducing bacteria into meat, and honey is really naturally antibacterial.
Right.
I mean, between the osmotic pressure of honey as an ingredient, and then also the fact that it produces hydrogen peroxide. It's just one of the natural byproducts, rather, of the enzymatic activity that occurs with glucose oxidase as the enzymes that the bees use change the blend of sugars for the production of a small amount of hydrogen peroxide as well. So it's a kind of a hostile environment for bacteria. Although I will say that we're kind of a non-interventionist in our approach. We don't sulfite before we start our fermentations, and we're not averse to the notion that there is going to be some microbiota that come from those cherries that we use and from the raspberries that we get from hunts. It's just part of the package, and what you get when you taste our mead is the full, you know, we do pitch yeast, but we don't discourage the naturally occurring yeasts that are on the fruit or any bacteria that, you know, kind of come along for the ride. We're not that freaked out about it.
Well, it seems, I mean, it takes care of itself, it seems. it doesn't seem like you have to do too much of it. As long as you've been making mead and you've not had to control it, that environment where it naturally is killing the stuff off. It's funny because I'm like, you know, because you do hear, and I think he has talked about doing drier meads when people are ready to drink drier meads. I think, is that your concern, is you're going to produce them and people won't drink them?
Well, that, and we really need to nail them down. When I was, you know, prepping what we were going to do as a product lineup, I went with meads that I knew were going to be, crowd pleasers, so that we wouldn't be fighting an uphill battle. We've already done one dry mead. A blackberry mead that we fermented dry, and then we did, getting back to the bacteria question, we did a malolactic, and we pitched Enococcus eni into it, and that did make for a really nice wine-style mead. Mm. But it really didn't move as well as our sweeter meads did, so we have not gone back to that as something that we're going to push into our regular product lineup.
What's the turnaround
time?
That's
smart, because that's what I did wrong. I just made...
I remember you said that those first 4 years. He was like, but nobody bought them. He was drinking a lot of sour beer from Jolly Pumpkin himself. What's the turnaround time from the time you start a batch of mead till you release it? And are you barrel finishing, or will you do any more... I don't want to say creative, because your stuff is really great, but do you have any plans on doing some barrel finishing that's less usual?
We've got a batch of our ginger mead right now in a bourbon barrel.
Ooh, I want to try. Nice.
Yeah, a local shop down here in the Detroit area. It's a really high volume store. Mm-hmm. Off the market came to us and said, we've got this Calumet Farms barrel. Would you like to fill it with some mead as a project with our store? And we bid on that, and we have ginger in there, and we're gonna be following up on that. There are a couple of other stores that have barrels that they bought and bottled, and would like to try and do barrel projects with us on. So yeah, we'll be following up more on that. We're not averse to it. Our feeling is we're going to move into it slowly, and as production capacity and also experience with this allows, we don't want to just start going crazy with it. We want to move into it carefully.
Mm-hmm. So what, from the time that you start, like the statement, from the time you began making it and to the time that you bottle it and release it, how much time is involved?
It's usually about 4 months for each batch.
Wow.
Yeah. It's long for brewers.
Yeah.
It's not
long for wine.
Long for fine. And other things, like The Heart of Darkness is usually at least 14-15 months old when it gets released.
Well, that's another reason why people can expect a higher price tag. I mean, it's not...
That's definitely something that gets aged properly before it does get released. But we usually do a primary fermentation of about 28 days. The fermentation itself is actually faster, but we leave it on the fruit for 28 days to get the flavor extraction. And then it goes into secondary. We go through a secondary and a tertiary phase just for clarity purposes, really, to let the fruit solids and the yeast drop out. And we try not to fine or filter. We fine occasionally, especially on things like spiced meats that have just a sort of an ornery haze that won't give up.
Oh, right. Do you filter after you doing the spices? Is that something that you filter out, or do you not filter?
We do not filter.
Okay.
Do not filter.
I want to ask this. Actually, Danner's going to has to go to his a work function with his wife. So before he leaves, I wanted to ask this, and of course I cut myself off like I cut everybody off. But so when I had talked to Matt about, and it was before we had actually scheduled this show, just talking about sour style beers and funky beers, and his experience was that his opinion was that he just doesn't like them. And I always say you just haven't had one that was done well. So what do you tell someone to look for? Because I think probably the best thing to do is tell somebody what's bad.
It's tough because I'm really kind of very particular about flavors and mostly with beer, but with food too. And there are things that I like and there are things that I don't like. And there are some beers that are really great beers that I just don't personally like. So I think there are also flavors that are problems in beers that are supposed to be sour beer or whatever you want to call it. The whole category thing, like, I can't tell you what the categories are. Well, I could generalize and tell you what the most people think the categories are, but I tend to not look at that, and I tend to blur lines, as I've had some tweeting conversations with Jeremy about and other folks about thinking of new things, because what I'm trying to do is create new beers and new flavors and things that take elements of different styles and put them together into something wonderful and beautiful. So with somebody like Matt, I would say, what is it you don't like about these sour beers that you've tried? Do they taste like dirty diapers? Well, great, because I don't like that either.
Yeah, they taste like
Winnebago.
I don't
like
that
either.
And so dirty diapers isn't
good. Usually not. But we have to find a conversation and a vocabulary, because sometimes when I say dirty diapers and when you say dirty diapers, we're talking about two different flavors or aromas. Not that I don't think I ever ate a dirty diaper, but we're talking about two different aromas maybe and perceptions. And so we have to find a common vocabulary. And then once we have a common vocabulary, we can go forward and we can find a beer that I think you're going to enjoy, because you enjoy pickles. And we have beers that people tell me have dill pickle notes to them, which I'm like, dill pickle? Really? Gross. But they love it. Uh-huh. And so I would say, why don't you try this beer that people say have these dill pickle notes? And if you like dill pickles, hopefully you'll enjoy that. So that's how I would approach that with a novice to the sour category. It's like, what do you like? What don't you like? What's good? What's bad? And what are some of the classic things? And just kind of work through it that way. But there's definitely some bad technique out there producing sour beer right now, like really bad. Like, you think you can just let it cool off overnight and throw it in a barrel and it's going to be great. And, you know, sure, some places they do that. But just because you did that doesn't mean it's going to be awesome. And people need to taste their own beers and say, honestly, is this tasting good? Because I do that every day. And even today, it's generally Mondays, but we sometimes do it on other days. If we go through all the beers that I'm going to release for the week you know, that have come through conditioning. And I'm like, no, no, no. What the fuck? No. Okay, that one's pretty good. That one's pretty good. Sell that one. And I think that more brewers need to be honest about that. And then also, you know, kind of look at the science a little bit too.
It was a question that I wanted to pose to both of the guys because they've been in their respective categories for so long, but between home brewing and then actually being in commercial production, there's such an enormous influx of stuff on the market. And you both really have paid your dues between education, you know, writing books, working for other breweries. And there's this immediacy, like people get into brewing, they homebrew and they immediately want to be a brewery owner.
And they're so successful. I'm like, I wish I could sell that many barrels.
Well, I think there's like an odds game going on. I think that there's a certain number of people that are just, they're good. They have like, they have a natural talent for it. There's a lot of bad stuff, and we can talk. I mean, I don't focus on the bad stuff, and I certainly try not to feature the bad stuff. But it's a weird. So you see these guys that have like, you know, for decades have been working at their craft, and they're so revered, and everybody looks up to them for information. Then you get these guys out of the gate. There's like, I'm a brewmaster. I'm so good. And not in a negative way, but what is your take on that? When you see these guys that they don't want to work on any under anybody for any period of time and really learn really how to make a lot of the mistakes that you have to make before you're in commercial production, the stuff that will put you out of business if you do it too often. But so do you, you know, you have to see it. And I know you guys have opened a can and opened a bottle and thought, why are these people making beer for a living? And I do. It's not something I ask people that often, because most of the people we have on have really only been brewing from anywhere between like a year to just a couple of years. And of course, they are the people that, whether they went to great brewing schools, they had great mentors. I don't meet a lot of people who are doing fantastic beer that did not look to other people who know what they're doing and are making great beer, great spirits, great wine. So do you guys have an opinion on that or no? Because I know Ken gets a lot of questions, and it's a very, and I know you both are really great about sharing your knowledge, but there is that line, you know, where Ken was like, you know, now this is a career. This is like what he does for a living and how he wants his daughter and son and his grandchildren he wants to pass this on to them. It's like, he's not going to give away all the proprietary information that you want now. So it's like, you have to learn it from somewhere. You can't go to everybody and be like,
I kind of completely disagree. I want everybody's beer to be the best it can be, because if it's not, a person is less likely to try mine. I mean, the reason that there's been a lot of reasons, small and large, that we're still in business, but it's that people have enjoyed our beer, other brewers, and asked how we make it so that they can make their beer better. And a person in their market would never try my beer. I mean, who is Jolly Pumpkin from Dexter, Michigan? They're making sour beer, whatever. But then your local brewery makes a sour beer that you really like, whether it's a oak aged or, you know, lacto in a tank or whatever it is. And you like it. You're like, hey, this is pretty interesting. I might try this other brewery's beer. So I think without me, because when I started, there was so little information. It was so hard to find things out. I had to make tons of mistakes every day and almost go out of business every day for years. That anything that I can do to help people make better beer, because I go out and buy a lot of beer. I mean, people see me in the supermarket. I ran into the mayor of our little village in the supermarket just yesterday, and he's like, Ron, you have a shopping cart full of beer. You own a brewery. What are you doing? And I'm like, yeah, I drink a lot of beer, and I want every one of those beers to taste great and amazing. And so anything that I can do, I mean, it's technique. Proprietary knowledge is, you know, whatever. It's technique that makes it. So I can tell you anything that I know, and you still, unless you come and study my technique, you still won't make the same beer.
Well, that's the one I always say to people. What?
I just want to get in and comment on the notion of proprietary.
Yeah.
I certainly have shared a lot of information on how to make mead.
Yes.
And I'm not absolutely. I'm not going to stop going out and making presentations to try and help people improve their mead.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the question that I get, and I don't know how you feel about this, Ron, is, I mean, I get people asking me for exactly
formulas,
how
yeah.
to make. Yeah. Tell me exactly what you use. Tell me who you're, tell me every detail. And while I appreciate,
well, we get that with I get that with homebrew magazines all the time. Like, what's the recipe for Oro de Calabaza Blanca? I'm like, you want it? Here you go. Go ahead and brew it. You know? I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, if you look through the, all, I mean, I've shared the recipe for pretty much everything we make, and they're all out on the web right now. So, yeah. So I'm not gonna. If you want to find it, it's out there. And I certainly have published. I mean, there are people that are making the recipes out of the book right now and selling them. And good for them. Congratulations. I'm delighted. I mean, there are people out there that are literally making the recipes that I published.
You hear that, David Chin? But David Chang gets super pissed off every time he sees a recipe that's similar to something that he makes, and he gets pissed off about it.
Oh, come on. It's really, just a list of
Danner,
ingredients.
You know it's true.
I mean, it's the technique. It's the preparation. So, I mean, all those guys that are making that mead, they're not like yours. It's not going to taste like yours. I mean, it might taste similar. I mean, I've tasted some, BAM clones that are similar, whatever, but it's different. You know, it's just...
Yeah.
They can't do what you do.
Is anybody
they
more
can.
Chill than Ron Jeffries? Nobody. I'm gonna slip in real quick and tell Danner, is there anything that you want to ask before you head out?
I wanted to ask Ron, and we may have talked about this before, but with sours growing, the category is getting huge. People want to take sours, and they immediately, like, we just released Love Child number 6, and somebody asked us, hey, is this ready to drink? And I said, well, it's in the bottle. We sold it to you. it's ready to drink. And I think it's like if you went to a restaurant, and we'll use David Chang because we like to pick on him. And like, if he dropped your steak off at your table and he said, hey, you might want to cook that for a few more minutes, that would be a weird thing, because it's his job to deliver things that are ready to drink. How do you feel about, aging sours in particular, and then the idea of aging beers without ever tasting them? The first question is, you should age this. I imagine you know how I feel, but I'm curious how you feel.
I think we're, based on how you laid out the question, I think that we're on the same page 100%. I mean, every beer that I release is like a birthday cake, and I was just describing earlier about how I taste every beer that we release. Most of them many times before I release it. And so when I release it, it's ready for you to drink. And if you want to age it, that's okay. Because, I mean, I don't recommend it. I mean, if you want to, it might taste better to your palate. It may taste not so great to your palate. There's wild yeast. There's bacteria in there. It's going to continue to work. Mm-hmm. It will make more acidity. It will make more carbonation. And if that is your personal taste, then you might like that. But when I release it, I don't release it till it's ready to drink, and it's ready to drink right then. But, to the analogy to the break room and the brewers in the break room, there are guys who like stale chips. Like, I have little chip clips that I'm like, hey, you want a chip clip to put on your bag of chips? And they're like, oh, no, I like to let it air out for a day. And I'm like, seriously? Yeah, it's going to get all like
your chips, dude.
Weird and stale. But there are people who like that. No, seriously. And they do the same thing with bread. And I'm like, really? So, it's just personal taste. But I agree with you that it's... kind of weird. It's like telling the chef, like, can I eat this now, or should I go home and cook it for a few more minutes?
Right. Yeah.
No. It's pretty much ready now.
Right. Like, should I take this home and cool it down, and then I'm going to heat it up tomorrow?
But do you think a lot?
For maybe a year.
Do you think a lot
maybe
of the
3 years?
Do you guys think that comes from a lot of the people who started drinking American craft beer had come from like the Trappist, the Belgian stuff, where Oh,
no, not at all. I think this is a totally created artifice of the craft beer industry.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, because
yeah,
I mean, I absolutely. Started.
Yeah. My I mean, absolutely. There are people saying that you should age my beer because it, I mean, I assume in parentheses, because it kind of sucks right now.
Oh.
You know?
There are certainly
oxidation flavors that can be pleasing, like sherry notes and whatnot. But, and I understand, I mean, obviously, I run a brewery. There's economics involved. I need to move beer out the door. I need to keep the lights on, stuff like that. But, you know, really, when I release a beer, you should be able to drink it now. And if you want to age it, you know, you might like it better, but you might not. And so, especially, it's annoying to follow up on Jeremy when I get an email from somebody who bought a beer and aged it for 3 years, and then they write me that they didn't like it. And I'm like, okay, it's a 3-year-old beer.
It sat on my windowsill for
exactly.
3 years and it sucked.
Right. Well, and then it's not even to say that his beer should be, but like, how was it handled? What was the temperature like? I mean, it's too soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You go through all that in the email, but it's at the end of the day, it's like, it was good when it left my dock, it was tasting pretty good. I'm really sorry. I mean, who hasn't bought a crate of oranges and there's a moldy one in the bottom? Do you write the produce people and be like, I have a moldy orange in the bottom of my clementine thing? Like, no.
Yeah.
Silly.
And you better make it right or I'm going to tell my friends about your oranges, man.
Right.
Exactly.
Danner. Danner. So, Dan, I mean, I always say that if you are not following Jeremy Danner on Twitter, follow Jeremy Danner.
Yeah.
It's super
please
funny.
Don't call the brewery to get mad at me, though.
No, but I am right.
I'm still calling the brewery.
But, no, right? Well, I always say that, Ron, because Ron knows exactly the kind of stuff I'm talking about. When he came on as a columnist, I'm like, you get your own email address because you're feeling you're fielding all of your own complaints on one of your. But you haven't written anything yet that's going to upset anybody, which I'm okay.
Not yet.
Yeah, not yet. I told him we need to ease, like, we need to like ease people in, let them trust you before you pull the rug out from under them. Danner, go. I don't want Randall to get mad at me. Go to your party. I did see that some questions have come in on Twitter that you had. So I will ask for them. I'll ask the guys.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me tonight.
All right, no problem. Have a good one. I'll talk to you soon. I'll get back in touch with you about your
call.
Right, bye.
Yeah, later, man.
Perfect. Bye, guys.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
When I say bye, guys, nobody else leave. So I wanted to say that Ken, and I'm not sure if this was directed to Ron, to Boulevard, or to both of you. One of the listeners wanted us to ask you to do, ask you to do a collaboration with y'all. That would be Flames, which I guess is like fire. Like, you know, those Midwesterners love their fire.
Oh, it's called a shit up there. Fire.
No, well, okay.
Yeah, it's not a party till someone lights a couch on fire. Not
so
in Michigan.
He would like to see. He would like to see you guys. And have you?
It's a good beer name.
You know how? Right, have you thought about doing any collaborations? I mean, his stuff is one of those things that I think is probably a harder, except for doing like the barrel stuff, to keep within your own area. I wonder, like, would you do? You know, like. I would think of mead as being a little bit harder to do a collaboration, unless he wanted to hop a mead, unless he wanted to do something like outside of like the traditional mead style.
Well, I don't want to jump in too fast, but I've been collaborating Ron's beer with my mead for a long time.
Did you know that, Ron? You're drinking his beer while you're making your mead, right?
It was a while ago. I'm mixing them. I'm pouring them in the glass at the same time.
Oh, good. Nice. Oh, okay. I did want to ask you that because I saw you post something, and admittedly, I am not a soda drinker. It's just not my thing. But I'm so curious. I don't know if I would think of putting Coca-Cola in the statement. Like, I don't know if I would do that to the statement. Would you do that?
I would not.
I have a feeling it's probably delicious,
yeah,
but I'm like, yeah, it's so good. But
no.
I saw that people were like, oh yeah, this is the stuff. Like you like, and they were packaging it like at the meadery, like for people. So I'm assuming that's a thing. Is that a Michigan thing? Like the
I mean, we just let our notion is if you can find a way to enjoy our mead, please
Yeah.
Enjoy it.
It's so good on its own.
I don't make those myself.
Okay.
But we had people, we have a lot of people coming into the meadery who are just interested in trying something new. And
okay. I didn't know if I was missing the boat on.
It turns them on to the category.
Yeah.
By all means, yeah.
Yeah, if I was looking for people to collaborate with, Coke would probably not have been on my.
Thank you. Thank you.
The top of my list, but I'm sure Ron gets it at his places. You know, you have people that come in there who are part of a party who's not really, they're not coming in there because they're really just dedicated sour beer fans.
Mm-hmm.
And
those
people come into the meadery every so often, and if we've got something we can give them that sort of keeps them amused while they're there.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, and I wanted to ask you,
it's all about amusement.
Now that you're upping your production, will we start seeing you in more states? Will you guys start? Are you just going to focus on your state for right now?
Are you talking to me,
yes,
or Ron?
Yeah, no, you. You.
Oh, Ken. Well, we're looking to try and strike a deal in Ohio. We're in discussions with a distributor right there, or down there right now. And I'm sure other people on the call can back up the notion that you've got to really select the right distributor to move your product. If you're in a specialty product line, they've got to appreciate it, and some of this stuff has to be kind of hand sold, especially mead. I still have yet, people say, you're Ken Schramm, and if you know about mead, that's great, but I have never been recognized in an airport.
I'll start stalking you. I'll be that person.
Yeah, it's like being the Tiddlywinks champion of the world. When you're at the Tiddlywinks championship, man. If you're in that, if you make the final four, man, you're really big stuff. But if you leave that room, you're just another guy. And that's how it is with being a mead celebrity.
You're a celebrity to us.
It's a challenge to go out and work in other states and to try and get people in other places interested in you, because if mead's not really big there already, and Michigan is one of the few places where there is pretty good mead awareness, maybe Colorado and a few other states, but it's going to be a challenge for us to, go make waves in New York or someplace like that.
We'll have to get you on as a contributor sometime to talk about and craft, to talk about a little bit more. I feel like we got a little bit of a primer, with this issue. We had the bee nectar, and I was on the show that we did with Brad. I had reached out to Ken, and he's got a beautiful granddaughter now who's doing very well, but he was very, very busy with like family stuff. So now things are, maybe now with the brewery and the babies and doing really well, maybe we can get you on for a future issue. But yeah, I want to go through some of these questions real quick. And I want to talk about with Ron before we get off, but we do have his Gypsy series, which I was so stoked because I saw him share this, and he did with the Gypsy Brewers. Of course, we know all the guys, Brian from Stillwater, Yepa, and the twins, McKellar. He did with all the guys, who now it's really funny because now they're kind of all brick and mortar. It's funny to call them Gypsy now because they're all kind of, they're establishing roots. Which, Brian never said, but the other guys I never thought, especially Miguel was just like, didn't really, I think, want the responsibility, but he be with Aleworks now in California. Jolly Pumpkin, this is from Two Jokers on Twitter. Are you in search of a killer double wit recipe? I'm looking for a new dad. I don't know about that. Let me know, Ron, and I'll put him in touch with you.
I actually have a great double wit recipe we do every year. It's for the festivals here in Ann Arbor, right down the road. But otherwise I would be very interested. But
you're so nice.
Thank you. But yeah.
I want to, so Ashley, who is, she's actually part of the Craft Beer Nation group, the podcast, who they always try to get me on. I have to get on there one day, but she's very, very sweet. She's like home brewer, does all like the women, like the pink boots and all that good stuff. Huge fan of Ron. So she had a couple of questions, and I was a little confused by this, Ron, and I think this has to do with your business partners that have the separate Jolly Pumpkin locations. I was trying to remember, I had to try to go back and find the show, because the question that she had asked was, outside establishments that, outside establishments that go by the name Jolly Pumpkin that serve your beer, so I guess based on that, she's like, do you have any plans to try what you're doing with those other locations outside of Michigan?
Yeah, and actually those are all our company. We do have partners that
I was confused by her question.
Exactly. there's a lot of confusion on the whole company structure, but anything that's a Jolly Pumpkin restaurant or something, that's our company. Like we have the restaurant, the distillery,
I think
a number of other locations. And yeah, we're looking at places outside of Michigan for
She had asked
Jolly
about
Pumpkin.
Hawaii. Since you spend the time in Hawaii, would you do something in Hawaii?
Yeah, Hawaii is one of the places we're looking at. We're looking at a number of different spots. As we grow and expand our production as a brewery, we're also looking to do our restaurants in other places too. Lori and I are super focused on the brewery and production, and our partners are focused on restaurants. But those are all wholly owned by our company. It gets a little confusing because we do the North Peak beers also.
That's what I started. I was sitting here like I didn't want
right.
to. I think
but
that
we don't
that's
have,
where
we
came
don't
in.
Have any. Yeah, we don't
Jolly
have any.
Jolly Pumpkin is Jolly Pumpkin.
In,
yeah.
Right. And right. North Peak Brewing Company, the brew pub, we don't have any interest, but we do brew beers under that brand. But Jolly Pumpkin, yeah, if you go into a Jolly Pumpkin brew pub, that's ours.
All right. I hope I answered that question correctly, Ashley. I was a little confused as I tried to read
and then
it.
My follow-up question to her question would be, you know, where in Hawaii? Because Lori and I love Big Island, so we're thinking Big Island, but we've looked at spots on some of the other islands too.
Well, I will ask her that question and then get back to you. She said, what is your go-to? You know, it's funny. Because this is where Ron and I are a lot of like, well, we talked about this on the other show, and I think I let you know when I started to have the cheese column, because that was super important. Because, you know, like, I would totally, like, if I didn't have other people that ate meat around me, I would totally not eat meat, but I'm never giving up cheese. It's never going to happen. But Ron is a vegan who eats cheese. I kind of went back.
I was vegan for a long time, and then I thought, you know, I'm not going to live forever, and I really love artisan cheese. Yeah. So why am I denying myself this?
Well, she had,
at least in moderation.
Exactly. I mean, cheese is the business, right? Like cheese is
right.
So
cheese is life.
It is, and I know, like, I cannot emphasize that enough. It's so funny because people will talk about like chocolate or whatever. Like forget it. It's like, just don't touch my cheese. It's like the only thing like I'll have like. Cheese is, yeah. I'm like, yeah, but you're right. But I don't think of many other things like that. Yeah, cheese is the stuff. What is your go-to food when you're traveling? She remembers you're a vegan, and she's very cute because she said if that's not too personal.
Almonds, probably. Like if you like it in your bag, like food that you don't die.
Yeah,
because
she's
almonds.
A vegetarian. Yeah, beer and almonds. You could probably live for a very long time with beer and almonds, believe right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. There you go. And then I've got, let me ask the stuff that Corey had for Ken. On your fruit mead, roughly how many pounds of fruit is added per gallon of mead for the intense fruit character that Schramm's is known for?
Between 5 and 8.
Wow. For every gallon. That's a lot of fruit.
Ken, yep. You said you're fermenting on whole fruit. Are you including the pits and the cherries?
No.
Okay.
So it's,
we buy pitted fruit.
Oh, that would be so... Well, when I was explaining eau de vie to Matt, it was one of those things like, you know, like you'll get like grappa. Can you imagine just like cleaning out all that fruit? And there are people that do. With the eau de vie, they do. I don't know if they're buying a lot of... is the fruit added post-fermentation, mead is already mature, or during the primary fermentation of the mead?
It's added when we mix the batch together, the fruit and the... And the honey go in at the same time.
Is there ever an instance where you would do a post fermentation?
You know, I did them when I was a home brewer, and I did that because it's easier to extract a lot of fruit flavor from less fruit if you add it after fermentation is done. You've got the additional alcohol extracting flavor, but as I got. You know, as I started raising my own fruit, you know, the price of it became not an issue. And now that I'm actually making mead commercially, you know, I'm doing it at the beginning because I need to get the stuff to clarify.
Yeah.
And if I added it after the primary fermentation, we'd be right, you know, basically at square one. And instead of having a 4 or 5 month process, I'd have a 5 or 6 month process. So.
And your stuff tastes so good. There's no reason to change.
Yeah. Well, and it's a good story too. That whole thing about the Balaton cherry.
Oh yeah, I don't know if we explain it on the show. We explained it in the article.
We talked about it in the article real briefly. But
well, let me ask him this last question, and then he can talk about the cherries. Because both of the cherries are really from that area, but this one is only from this area, right? So, if the fruit is added post fermentation. Which it's not, but let me finish this question. Is there any re-fermentation of the new fruit sugars, or is the mead back sweetened with the fruit and their sugar contribution to the finished mead? Which would have been my question.
Does
it continue?
That was mine, yeah.
Yeah. Would that just.
No, when I was as a home brewer adding fermentation or fruit after the primary fermentation, yes, you do get additional fermentation, and you can often end up with higher alcohol levels that way as well. But you do end up with a renewed fermentation that happens as you add that additional sugar.
Yeah, I mean, and you forget. I mean, this goes down so easy. It's 14%.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we still have the statement is phenomenal. But yeah, you don't even realize when you're drinking it how high the alcohol level is.
Honestly, some of it is, there is that tartness from the cherry that really
it's
comes
perfect.
Through.
Like yeah.
It's, you get that sweet and the honey comes
out.
But
it's not treacly sweet.
No, definitely not.
Mm-mm.
No, it's deceptive.
Let's talk about the Gypsy series.
Yeah,
and how
the beer we're drinking
now
here.
So did you do now where's okay so the first one that we're drinking which we're drinking the one that you did with Brian from Stillwater. Do you guys want to
okay.
it's delicious. I and everybody when they saw that because so is this one of your like super limited releases that nobody else is going to get? Sorry people, I don't think there's tons of this out there, is there?
There's more of that than there is the Sea Buckthorn, which I think we also sent you guys.
Yeah.
We did 100 barrels of the beer with Brian. So it should get out to most of our distribution channels. It's not super abundant, but it's not super limited either. But
it's
yeah, it
very
turned out really
quaffable.
Well. It
yeah,
was
it's
great.
Very quaffable. Can I see the bottle?
Yeah, Brian was great. He had some really interesting ideas. We used wild lime and rose lemongrass tea, and it just turned out great.
It's delicious. And he really, Brian, out of all the guys, really even more, because the other guys, you kind of know the locations that they tend to frequent. Brian goes to some pretty outrageous parts of like South America. I mean, he is all over the board. So you definitely get that. I love that you guys use that wild lime because it's that like that twisty funky. It's so good. We're good. So
yeah, absolutely. He is. Every time I email him or text him, it's like, hey, I'm in Bolivia. I'm right. Like, okay. What are you doing there?
Let's talk about but you know, we'll ask you guys a few more things, but let's finish up talking about the Gypsy series. So what prompted doing the Gypsy series?
Well, The Gypsy Brewers, those three in particular, had been asking me for quite a while to brew beers with them. And it's a little different thing being a Gypsy Brewer versus, you know, owning your own brewery and having mortgaged your house and double mortgaged your house and mortgaged your house again and going back to the bank to ask for more money and then explaining why you didn't have the money to pay the bank back and you're asking for more money versus like, hey, I'm going to buy some labels and put it on some beer that's made in Westbrook or whatever. I mean, it's different.
Oh,
it's
totally
different. But those guys make some really great beers and they have some really interesting ideas about beer industry and marketing and promoting. And so in 2014, a lot of things came together. Earlier, we were at a different facility in Dexter, just about a mile from where we are now, and I really didn't have the capacity to brew any more beer. And so we were just struggling to keep up with our existing accounts and our wholesalers. And so I really couldn't do any collaborations or anything like that. And then we moved to our new facility in 2012, and it took a little while to get things working and get systems in place and figure out what we're doing in this new facility. And finally, I got to a place in 2014 where I was like, I can finally do some collaborations. So early in 2014, I put out a message to everybody on the internet through the normal ways you put messages out on the internet. I said, 2014 is collaborator, get the fuck out. And so I collaborated with those guys. And that's when we brewed all those beers. It ended up being later in the year, in 2014, we brewed those beers with Brian and then Yepa and then Nickel. I mean, it was really exciting to work with them and get their ideas on flavors and combinations and how to, you know, build the beers. So it was a long time in the making on all those beers, for sure.
And so, this is phenomenal. The Sea Buckthorn is phenomenal. I've never tasted a beer like this.
There's a lot going on in it too.
Yeah, and it's you know I always
it's getting
say
better
this
better every sip.
Well, and I'm always it's funny for me because you know I'll always get like those different places, which I think everybody should. You know, when you drink and you get the different parts of your mouth that are affected by
oh,
hops.
Yeah, for
I mean,
sure.
This to me is like yeah, all in the sure. front, which is not always like such a mm-hmm. pleasant one. You know, like you don't get it on the back end. It's so good.
Totally get it on the back end.
It'll, oh, I don't get it on the back. Yeah. I get it like all in the front. I love it.
As it warms up, you'll get it more on the back
yeah.
end.
No, no, I think
yeah,
it's yeah.
Really low IBUs, but the berries are very, as you said, kind of a bitter berry, and so they're going to be hitting your tongue right in the front. But as it warms up, and there's a lot of Brett character in that, and as it warms up, it'll start coming out, get a little more funky and a little more fruity on the back end.
Yeah, the fruit character is really nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Great for dill pickle lovers.
Yeah, sure. Matt would probably like this.
I told you.
I told you. Yeah, I mean, honestly, these are both, and of course, for very different. Now, it'll be funny when, you know, we go to drink the third one. I'm wondering, because you really, if we went to go line these up and taste them, already these are so, you know, and again, somebody will think like Matt, who's maybe had them and not liked them, to think that sour is just sour. And these have such different characteristics, the sour characteristics are completely different.
All three of them are completely different. And that goes back to what I was saying earlier about mm-hmm. what we're trying to do is not make a particular style or characteristic, but create all these flavors and all these different artistic interpretations of what a beer can be.
Yeah. Do you guys have any other questions before we let them go? Matt, any questions you want to ask?
I asked my stupid question.
Stupid. It was fantastic.
One last one for you, Ron, then. Sure. How are you getting this much strawberry flavor in the Innovator, man? I mean, that's like a strawberry when it's in the warm in the sun, you're about to pick mm-hmm. it. Like that aroma is unreal.
We bought some strawberry puree and we bought too much of it and we put it in.
Perfect.
There you go.
There it is. I love it.
Listen, guys.
Yeah, it's pureed strawberry, 100% natural pureed strawberry. And I mean, strawberry is such a light flavor. When I've done it before on smaller volumes, I haven't gotten the flavor I was looking for. So we
definitely the
went overboard.
The aromatic, I mean, the aroma's yeah. there and the taste. Yeah.
Yeah, we bought a lot of strawberry puree.
Well,
so this year, Charles, who's lead on our brewing company, we were just actually texting earlier today. He's like, we need to puree our own strawberries this year. And I'm like, no. No, we don't. It was an enormous amount of strawberries.
Yeah, I would imagine. Well, like, and I would think, isn't that like a thing that you have to do too, Ken, right? Like, or like, I can't imagine breaking down all this fruit to work with. Well, I'm going to let you guys go. Thank you so much for coming on. You know, hopefully we'll get you both on again another time in the future. Happy New Year, and thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Good talking to you.
Absolutely.
Thanks, guys. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Yo, you too.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Bye-bye.
Go back, repeat, trace the things that you don't want to see. With your hands and your hair.